I'm author and athlete Brad Kearns. Welcome to the Be Rad Podcast, where we explore ways to pursue peak performance with passion throughout life. Visit bradkearns.com for great resources on healthy eating, exercise, and lifestyle. And here we go with the show.
I'm glad I'm not seriously competitive anymore, because this is the worst thing you can possibly do, is undermine all your beliefs in the things that make you faster. I think there are very few people walking on this planet who can say, yeah, that time I ran, my best time, that's as fast as my genes would permit me to run. Running has prepared me well for the idea that even if everything I'm dreaming of comes true, life will go on the next day and I'll have to think of other dreams, because you can't just sort of float on that cloud indefinitely.
Hey, I want to tell you about Schwenk Grills. This is a revolutionary portable gas infrared grill that uses the exact same heating technology as the world's best steakhouses. You heat up to 1500 degrees Fahrenheit to grill the juiciest steak you've ever tasted in as little as 3 minutes. Can you believe it? That's right. You do not have to go to those crowded, noisy, super overpriced steakhouses anymore when you have the same technology in your backyard. And the Schwenk portable infrared grill is not just for steak. You can make chicken wings, hamburgers, seafood, lobster, vegetables. I make salmon in 3 minutes. They even have a pizza stone accessory. I want you to visit their very informative and mouth-watering website at schwankgrills.com. That's S-C-H-W-A-N-K. Everything you cook, faster, juicier. The speed is so important, so convenient. There's a drip tray on the bottom, so you let the juices drip down. I love the bison burger, the venison burgers. That's my game. And then you can add a mixture of butter, spices, whatever you want, into the tray. Pour it back onto your meat or your salmon for a huge improvement in flavor. Are you getting hungry? I am. Let's go to schwankgrills.com, S-C-H-W-A-N-K-grills.com, and up your home cooking game. This is a one-of-a-kind grill. I have a great discount code for you, of course. It's Brad150 to save $150 off your purchase of a Schwenk grill. Hey, listeners, welcome to a very interesting and fast-moving conversation with Alex Hutchinson, the best-selling author of the wonderful book Endure. He's a very popular columnist in Outside Magazine, covering topics related to sweat science. That's right, he is the expert on the scientific aspects of peak performance and the human limitations, especially relating to endurance. And I spend a fair amount of time at the start of the show having him recount his most extraordinary story of amazing improvement breakthroughs in his own running career as a middle distance runner in college. You're not going to believe some of these insights that are going to pull out, and they'll be really memorable. I can't stop thinking about his story when I first heard about it. I had to have him on the show, and we get into all kinds of aspects, including the popular central governor theory promoted by Dr. Timothy Noakes, which proposes that the brain is the true limiter of peak performance, not the fatigue that's happening in our muscles, in our extremities. And we also transition into talking about the ultimate limits of human performance, especially as it relates to the current world records and all the technological breakthroughs, as well as the training breakthroughs, where we're headed in the future. And I'll tee him up a little further with an excerpt from his book description about Endure, where Hutchinson reveals that a wave of paradigm-altering research over the past decade suggests that the seemingly physical barriers you encounter are mediated as much by your brain as much by your body. It's not all in your head. For each of the physical limits that Hutchinson explores, pain, muscle, oxygen, heat, thirst, and fuel, he carefully disentangles the delicate interplay of mind and muscle by telling the riveting stories of men and women who've approached and sometimes surpassed their own ultimate limits. And there's great stories about the explorers that went to the South Pole, Asmundsen, 100 plus years ago, and then recent efforts to kind of duplicate these amazing feats that you hear about in the history books. And I also like how he blends that mind and body insights, where it's not all in your head, but a lot of it is. And if you, for example, adopt a more empowering positive attitude about the journey that you're on, the exercise that you're doing, the workout that you're trying to finish, instead of feeling negative about it and wishing it for it to be over. You can say, boy, isn't the fresh air and this beautiful scenery wonderful? What a great way to spend my day. And thereby, you reduce your perceived exertion and you prolong your endurance. It's pretty awesome. So let's hear from Alex Hutchinson.
Alex Hutchinson, I'm so glad to connect with you. And we have all kinds of important stuff to talk about. Hopefully listeners are familiar with your wonderful book, Endure, and read your columns in Outside Magazine and Runner's World. That's the main place we're seeing these regular features.
These days, Outside is the main place, yeah. I was with Runner's World for a while, but anyway, Outside, and thank you for having me on, Brad. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So this concept of human endurance and all the aspects and attributes about that that you covered so nicely in your book, I think we have some important things to talk about, but I can't think of a better way to set the stage than to ask you to recap your amazing journey in distance running, where you became quite a serious runner, but the breakthroughs are to the level that I've never heard about of any other human ever. And it turns out you're the guy studying this. So I think you're going to have to wind us up, man, and take us back to your high school and college days in Canada, pursuing your dream of becoming a middle distance runner.
Yeah. I mean, I started out in high school, like a lot of people do, and running initially middle distance, like 1500 meters. And the big dream at that point was the call it the metric 4-minute mile. I wanted to run 4 minutes for 1500 meters, which is about, call it 17 seconds shorter than a mile. So it's, I was not trying to be Roger Bannister, but my own version of Roger Bannister. And I ran 4:02 in my second year of high school running. And I could plot out the trajectory, right? I could see that I was going to go well under 4 minutes the next year and, you know, make the Olympics the year after that and set the world right. You know, I had it all plotted out. But I hit a plateau pretty quickly. I ran between 4 flat and 4:02 for what turned out to be 4 straight years, which took me to my junior year of college. And so, you know, when I talk about human limits and discovering where the outer bounds of your potential are, that really goes back to that feeling that I had in high school and college, where it's like, okay, I know I've been training pretty hard for 4 years now. I've been doing the mileage, I've been hitting the weight room, I've been doing the speed work, I've been lying awake at night reading books about running, and I keep running about 4 minutes for 1500, just over 4 minutes. So I was very confident that I could get under 4 minutes, that I could run that 3:59. But I definitely had the sense that that was about what my body was capable of, that there wasn't a whole lot more in the tank. And so the turning point for me was a race in my junior year of college, not an important race, not a significant race, but just another race where I was going to go out and try and get that 3:59.9. And it was an indoor race, so 200 meter track. The gun went off and I took off in the lead trying to run my pace. And I went through the first 200 meters in, you know, the timekeepers there at the start line calling out splits. And I went through the first 227 seconds, which for anyone who's done any track running, knows that's pretty fast, and it's a hell of a lot faster than you want to be running if you're trying to run 4 minutes for 1500, which is 32 second pace. And I had this, I still can remember the sort of moment of like, whoa, that's way too fast. And yet, whoa, I feel pretty good. I actually feel under control. So, you know, I was just trying to stay calm, stay cool, came through the second lap in 57 seconds, which again is way too fast. But I felt just really, really under control and good. Same thing happened third lap. And so I had this, I can also remember, this is a race that took place in 1996. I'm an old guy now. But I can still remember that mid-race kind of decision of, or the realization that something special was happening and that I needed to kind of stop listening to splits, overthinking things and just run, because I was having a very, very special day. And it turned out to be a special day. I ran 3:52.4, which was a 9 second, or, you know, almost 9 second personal best. And what happened afterwards was so that was cool in and of itself. Like 9 seconds is a lot, but what happened afterwards is I was chatting to a teammate who had taken my splits for me, so that I, you know, as being a typical distance runner, I was ready to record the splits in my log and analyze them and plot them in Lotus 1-2-3 and all that stuff. And I, you know, I said, can you believe I ran the first lap in 27? He said, no, you didn't. What are you talking about? You ran the first lap in like 30 or 31. And anyway, to cut to the, sorry, I'm making this a long story, but to cut to the chase, the timekeeper had probably missed the start or something like that and was giving me the wrong splits. And so when he was telling me I'd gone out in 27, he was creating this impression in my mind that I was running really fast with less effort than normal. Whereas in reality, I was running pretty fast with pretty, you know, moderate effort, but he kind of tricked me into thinking I was having the best day of my life. And as a result, I kind of unshackled myself from my prior expectations, and I just ran. And all of a sudden, I had a 9-second personal best. And then, you know, the postscript is that in the race after that, I ran 3:49, and after that, I ran 3:44. And it was like a kind of tap had been turned on. And you know, honestly, I wish I could recapture that that sort of sequence of events. You know, if I could have bottled that, I would have gotten a lot faster. But I didn't. You know, I eventually hit another plateau, and it's not as knowing that there are such things as mental barriers doesn't mean it's easy to turn them off. But it definitely, that one race in 1996, I think, is what set me on a path that ended up with the book I published in 2018, Endure, because I've been fascinated ever since with trying to understand what defines our limits, and knowing that that it's not just a formula. You know, it's not a VO2 max test. It's not that there's a lot more in there that defines what we're capable of.
In other words, you're still trying to figure it out 20 plus years later. We still don't know what happened to this guy.
I would say I'm even, in some ways, I'm even more confused than I was then. the less you know, the more you think you know. And so the deeper I've gotten into it, the more I've realized that there's a lot still to learn, for sure.
That's the sign of a good scientist, when you, you keep heading toward more realization, that you realize how little you know. So congratulations there. Yeah. Instead of here's Alex, who knows everything about endurance and performance limitations. Let's hear from him. No,
it would be nice.
Yeah.
Be
yeah. Nice, wouldn't it? So I want to set the context there. When you're around a 4 minute 1500 meter runner, that is I'd say very good high school level, probably national caliber Canada, or, you know, in America, you'd be one of the top guys in the state, and you'd be looking at a college career. And then, you know, hopefully they were hoping you would improve. But if you're running 4 minutes in college, you're a pretty good and very highly trained runner. So it's not someone who's jumping into their second race and getting a 9-second PR. So there was absolutely no, there was no dream of anyone at your already pretty fast level popping out a 9-second PR. And I've heard it just does unheard of.
So, I mean, yeah, to sort of expand on that context, when I started running, I think I ran my, like everyone else, I ran, you know, untrained stuff in early high school. And then I had showed some promise. I joined a track club. In Canada, track clubs are fairly common outside of high school. And I ran like 4:44, 4:45 for my first race. And then I got some training in and I ran 4:28. And this is all within one season. And then I went to the city finals and I ran 4:19. And then I went to the regionals and I ran 4:17. And then I went to the provincial finals, which is our equivalent state finals, and I ran 4:13 in the heats and 4:08 in the final. Mm-hmm. So there was this sort of 20 seconds over the course of, a month, let's say. That's not mysterious. That's training. That's learning how to race. That's very, very common. But as you say, once you've been training for a while, the fruits become much harder to grasp. And I always say, you know, whenever I'm talking to people, and whenever someone comes up to me and says, "Oh yeah, I had an okay race. It was a best time, but only by a second." I'm like, never take a best time for granted, because they get a lot. The farther you get in the sport, the harder they are to get. Mm. And so by the time I was running 4 minute, 4:02 for 1500, I've been training with a track club for a few years. I've been, running 6 or 7 days a week, doing interval workouts with a very good coach who knew what he was doing. So I wasn't just sort of bumbling along and discovering the sort of secrets of life. And in fact, you know, so I told this story in my book, right? And so people have heard it. And my old high school coach, when he read it, he's like, trying to remember those days, surely there were some signs in your training that you were ready for a big breakthrough. And I was like, well, you know, you can always find, you know, if you look carefully enough, you can say, oh, maybe that will work out, suggest something. But look, I'll give you my training logs. I'll take out my training logs. You tell me if you think I was ready to get 17 seconds faster over the course of a few weeks. So I gave him my old training logs, and he took them home. Actually, he still has them. He's giving them back to me. But anyway, he took them home, and he, you know, we chatted a couple weeks later. And I said, so, well, you know, what's the deal? And he said, yeah, you know, there was no, like, Well, so before I had my breakthrough, it was clear I was ready to run under 4 minutes. So I was working out better than a 4 minute guy, but I was not working out like a 3:44 guy, which I ended up. So it's like I went from slightly underperforming to dramatically underperforming. But it was, the change wasn't that I started working out better. I'd been working out at that level for a year or two without any, there was no obvious sign in the training that something had changed.
Right. So you were stuck running slower than you quote unquote should based on your impressive training log.
Yeah, no, not a ton, I would say. Like the trainings that I should have probably run, you know, under maybe 3:55, 3:58, 3:57, something like under 4 minutes. I was never like a hero trainer or anything. And I, you know, that's another topic, obviously.
Right.
I don't think this is necessarily a good thing to be a hero trainer. Like I think it's a good thing to sort of keep your powder dry. But yeah, I think people thought I should be ready to break four, but breaking four and running 3:52 are two different things.
Interesting. I didn't know about your early progression from novice and then down to a provincial finalist. So that's very interesting because you had this pattern wired into your brain of a guy who just kept knocking, you know, slashing the clock, even though it was, as you described, expected when someone starts putting on the shoes and running around a track and practicing, you expect that. But you did have that reference point somewhere in the recesses of your consciousness that it's already happened. So here it goes again with the 9 second PR. And then you didn't rest there.
I think that's a really interesting point. And I think it's probably connected to the fact that, first of all, I kept training at a very serious level with running as one of the most important things in my life into my 30s, and I'm 46 now, and I'm still training every day. I think it reminds me of those that, you know, they did those conditioning experiments with like rats or whatever, or the psychology experiments, half a century ago, where they find the best way to get a rat to keep pressing a lever is not that five presses gives you a nugget of food. It's that an unpredictable, every once in a while, you hit the jackpot. Mm. And this is the way casino slot machines are designed too. It's like the unpredictable. So I had this hardwired into me that you just keep training. Sometimes it seems like nothing is happening. And every once in a while, bam, you hit a hot streak. And so I kept waiting and waiting and waiting to go, you know, to get another, more hot streaks and to go on another tear, because I've had this happen a few times where it's like, You're in a plateau. Then once you finally break through, you know, when it rains, it pours. So, yeah, maybe I'm like the rat in the cage there, expecting the big reward nugget at some point.
Tristan Harris calls it intermittent variable rewards. And that's why slot machines are so addicting. And I guess perhaps running, especially in your case, not for most runners, because they don't have these incredible breakthroughs. They're not too common, but that's interesting. You know, it kept you in the game. And I guess we should... Yeah, we should talk about your time progression there. So you were a pretty good college runner, and then you shattered the barriers with that 3:52. But then to take it in a matter of weeks, now all of a sudden you're national class and you're lining up with the Canadian heroes and Olympians. So that part, how do you justify going from what you finally hit your potential and maybe even better than your predicted potential, and now you're in the stratosphere somehow?
That was a really interesting experience.
And did you get totally full of yourself, swagger around campus with the gold chain now all of a sudden? How did that go in your psychology?
The gold chain that I'm wearing right now, yeah. it's interesting because, you know, to go back to the context of as a 401 guy, I had big dreams. We all have big dreams. I went to bed every night dreaming big dreams. Mm. But those big dreams were like, someday I'll run 3:53 or 3:54 or 3:55. And so all of a sudden I ran 3:44. And that race was, I mean, there's a whole story to that race too, because that's another big gap to go from 3:49 to 3:44. I was in the fast heat of a meet where I should have been. Everyone else was in it was a meet held at my university. And I remember showing up a few hours before the race and looking at the heat sheets posted on the wall and seeing that I was in the faster heat. And there were a couple guys standing there reading the heat sheets, and they were saying, what the hell is Hutchinson doing in this fast heat? What the hell? I run faster. We should be, you know, like the people were angry about that because my coach was the meet director and had put me in the fast heat ahead of a bunch of guys who were faster than me. And so when I stepped to the line that day, you know, this is a different element of psychology. Mm. It was like, I was like, I have to finish second last. I have to finish second last so that I'm not the one who should have been in the last heat. And so I ran in dead last in that race for 1,200 meters. And then with 300 meters to go in the race, I did a little internal check and was like, hey, I've still got fuel to burn. And I passed about eight people in the last 300 meters. And it was a, you know, a huge race, like almost probably more surprising than the 352 in a lot of ways. It's harder to explain, but, you know, as you know, 344 is a different world than 352, more so than 352 to 401.
Mm.
And so that actually...
exponentially more so, of course, because now you're bumping up against Olympic caliber playing. Yeah.
Well, so this was, and this was in the mid-90s, which another important piece of context is people were slower in the mid-90s. So these days, 344 would not, you know, wouldn't get you a ticket to any big meets. But at the time... in Canada, which is a smaller country, it had qualified me for the Olympic trials a few weeks later. And so I found myself suddenly, you know, 2 months ago, I was a 401 guy. Now I'm stepping to the start line against the Canadian record holder. And there's a, you know, I guess I mentioned this in the book, there's a YouTube video of the 1996 Canadian Olympic trials. And I'm on the start line next to my absolute hero, Graham Hood, who's made the Olympic finals already. You know, he's an Olympic finalist, defending Olympic finalist. I am just absolutely petrified, and the way that worked out is I ran like a hunk of crap in the Olympic finals. I made it to the final, but I ran like junk. I didn't yet believe that I belonged. And I came back 12 months later. It took me that long to be like, no, I've run these times in the low 340s. I belong here. And the next time the next year I came fourth at the national championships. And I wasn't necessarily all that much fitter, but I ran with confidence instead of running scared out of my mind and thinking that I didn't belong with those people.
I guess it's hard for a lot of endurance athletes, myself included, to buy into this idea that our mindset is holding us back, because I know what that last lap feels like, or that last mile, 3 miles of the marathon, or whatever your reference point is, where you say, no, there's no way I could have gone any farther. And this is how well I'm trained, and so forth. But this opens up, I think, a whole bunch of avenues for discussion. The central governor theory that's been popularized by Dr. Tim Noakes, and that you covered nicely in your book. It's really fascinating to me. That the brain is suggested that it's the ultimate arbiter of performance limitation, rather than that your muscles actually got tired and your lower back cramped and this and that. So I'd love to just get going on that discussion. And also, let's say it is true, and we all have reference points where we had these amazing breakthroughs and we made it to the top of the mountain, even though we were tired and it was pouring rain. But then how do you balance that insight with day-to-day regulation of your energy so you don't get overtrained and burnt out?
Yeah.
There you go. And I'll be back in 15 minutes, Alex, because I just teed you up big time.
I was just going to say, there's a lot to unpack there. I think the first thing I want to say is to agree with what you said about it being difficult to, certainly for me, and I think for a lot of other people, to really, really, truly believe that, yeah, the thoughts in your head are going to affect your performance, because nothing feels as objectively real and true as the feeling of muscular fatigue or you know, at the end of a race. You don't feel like, oh, I could have chosen to gone faster. Like, especially once you've trained for a certain amount of time and you're highly motivated and you're starting a race thinking, you know, I would stab myself with a needle to, you know, or with the, I should say safety pin, so it doesn't sound like I'm doping myself. I would stab myself with a safety pin if that would make me run faster. I'm willing to accept all pain. And then in the end of the race, you're going as hard as you can and you just couldn't go any faster. So then someone comes up to you and said, boy, maybe if you thought, thinking, you know, positive thoughts, you would have gone faster. You're like, what are you talking about? So I really struggled with that. And I am a very empirical sort of show me the evidence. Like, if you think this helps, show me a double blinded peer reviewed study that demonstrates it. And so I had to balance, or I had to hold in opposition that approach to the world, which I think is pretty common among endurance athletes. They tend not to generalize, but they tend to be a fairly analytical species. I had to balance that with my own experiences that we've just been talking about of like, oh, all of a sudden I got a lot faster. How did that happen? And so then when I came across Tim Noakes' research about the central governor model, this idea that your limits are dictated by your brain trying to prevent you from reaching the edge of your physical capacities rather than that you actually reach your physical capacities. It made sense to me because I couldn't find any other way of reconciling this, the feeling of what it's like at the end of a race, the feeling that you've really hit your limits, with the reality that when I ran 4 flat or 4:01, I thought I was going as hard as I could. When I ran 3:52, I also thought didn't feel that different. I wasn't more tired at the end. So how do you explain those differences? And I think even through the writing Endure, which delves into this stuff a lot, I gave a talk not long after the book came out, and someone stuck up their hand at the end saying, you know, I read the last chapter and it sounded to me like you actually still don't believe it. Like the end of the book is like saying something about, I can't remember the line, but it's something like, there's more, you know, when you're pushing as hard as you can, there's more in there if you can convince yourself to believe it or something. And I thought about it, and it was one of those moments where I had the sense that, oh, this someone else on the exterior of my brain was able to perceive what I was thinking better than I was. And I realized that, yeah, you're right. Even in writing the book, I still am skeptical. I still have trouble accepting the idea that that our thoughts have such an important role to play. So it's something I struggle with to this day, to be honest.
Yeah, I would say, being that you've spent your career and you have that analytical bent, as you describe, and I can totally relate to that. And I remember back when I was racing on the professional triathlon circuit, mixing with some of the best athletes, and some of them were completely raw and intuitive and non-scientific minded. And it seemed, especially to me, analyzing the situation, that could be considered an ideal competitive mindset, where you're just out there and you're tapping into these raw instincts. And if you get your ass kicked, you say, F that, I can't wait till the next race. And instead of breaking down your nutritional macronutrients and the 3-week buildup to see if, you know, there's some area that you can identify. I wonder if you've mixed with, you know, athletes with a vastly different mindset and approach than you, and see any compare and contrast to what represents kind of the ideal competitive disposition.
100%. Lots of things to say. One is, I don't think there's an ideal competitive disposition. There's there's many roads to roll, right? Mm. But there are different. There are some very different ones. And I will say, once I got into being a science journalist, then where my sort of main job was, let's look at studies testing all the theories that athletes have about what makes them faster, and let's look at the evidence and let's debunk all these mistaken beliefs, I pretty quickly came to the conclusion, I'm glad I'm not seriously competitive anymore, because this is the worst thing you can possibly do, is undermine all your beliefs in the things that make you faster. Because I have had experiences like the one you described. And in fact, I had a coach in the early 2000s. I trained with a group run by Matt Centrowitz Sr., the former American 5,000 meter record holder, the father of the 2016 Olympic 1500 meter champion. And he just had a completely different approach than I did. He was an extremely intuitive athlete. He was a very talented, intuitive coach, rather. And as an athlete, he'd been an intuitive athlete. He qualified for the Olympics as a college student in the 70s. And he wasn't interested in, you know, let's do this kind of interval at this percentage of VO2 max in order to optimize this physiological system. He was very much just kind of feeling it. And I remember let me tell a couple of stories, because one was, he'd tell me to go out and do a fartlek. And I'd say, well, how long should the fartlek? I don't know, whatever, you know, make sure it's a good effort. You need to get some mileage in. Say, okay, well, how long should the hard surges be? And how long should the recoveries be? You'd say, well, go hard until you feel like you've pushed hard enough, then take a break till you recover, then go hard again. And my head would be on the verge of exploding. I'd be like, no, I need to know how many minutes I'm going hard. How can I know how hard to go until I know how many minutes I'm supposed to go and how much the rest is? But he was trying to teach me something that I wasn't quite ready to learn at the time, to feel where my limits are, and then to step back from them and to feel them again.
Yeah.
And the other story, just on that note, from Matt, you know, he had a couple, while I was there, he had a couple runners qualify for the NCAA championships, a couple of milers. And so before they left, he pulled them over during practice one day to give them some tactical advice. And I was, since I was a competitive miler at a similar level, I was in that group sort of listening to his advice to them before going to the NCAA championships, which, and 1500 meter races are famously tactical. Usually it's not just the gun goes and everyone runs as fast as they can, especially in the qualifying rounds. There's a lot of like, it'll go slow, it'll go fast, there'll be a move, there'll be a counter move. Everyone's watching everyone else in a big pack, and then there'll be a big move that you can't miss, and then a counter move. And so knowing when to go. And so Coach Centrowitz was trying to explain to these guys, here's what you need to do. And it wasn't like, you run at this pace until 600 to go. 600, you go into gear 4. And then at 300 to go, you got to go into gear 5. He was like, you know, when you walk into a bar, and you can sense there's going to be a fight soon. You can just sense in the, and I was thinking like,
no,
hell no. I've never seen a fight in my life. Like, I don't know anything about Chuck, but he's like, yeah, you go into a bar, you can sense, you know, someone's going to start something soon. There's just that electricity in the air and you got to feel it. Don't go too soon, but wait. You just got to wait until the moment just before, you know, the first punch is going to be thrown. Bam, you throw your punch. And I was like, I love that advice. I don't know how to follow it. But the two guys, Sean Duffy and Sean O'Brien, who were great milers for American, they learned to trust Coach Centrowitz to just sort of, and they sort of got in tune with them, and they were great runners as a result. And they learned this intuitive approach that escaped me. And so I think it's not to say there was nothing that could have been optimized or changed about the program there, but there was an important in retrospect, I look back, and even at the time I had the sense, there's a language here, there's a lesson here that is hard for me to learn, and that I would be better if I could learn it. And that's to do with sort of being able to feel where your limits are, and rather than letting them be externally imposed by some idea of how fast you should be able to run.
Yeah, and also that fear you describe when you got up to the big leagues really quickly without that proper psychological preparation. And so, of course, you feel like you don't deserve to be standing next to Graham Hood and shaking his hand. Good luck, man. I'll see you at the finish line. And I think most people can relate to that. And I'm thinking of my time that I shared with Lance Armstrong when he was a triathlete. And then later during his Tour de France career, I wrote a book about him and had some time to interview him and things. And he sort of projected the opposite, where even when he was a kid, and if you know his story, he came in, started racing against the top pros in the world in triathlon when he was 15, 16 years old. And, you know, I'd meet with this guy at the races, and he was absolutely fearless, and he had no reverence for even the greatest athletes who were my heroes that I'd worked hard to finally get up to be able to compete with them. And it was such an honor to compete with these great guys. He was like, oh, those guys are wussies. I'm going to take it out hard on the bike and make everyone suffer. And he'd verbalize these things as a punk kid. And he came off poorly in many ways with the media at first because he was so brash and cocky. But to me, it was such a rich experience to look at this guy who was not just blow hard. He deeply, you know, thought and believed that and embodied that persona. And it seemed like, and I talk about this in the book I wrote about him, that, you know, I asked him, do you feel those nervousness and that pressure when you're leading this team? And in fact, the entire organization is counting on you winning the tour. And he goes, no. And I go, why not? You mean you're the man, you have the most pressure of anybody. And he goes, oh, no. The guys who have the real pressure are the ones fighting for their jobs to be the domestique. And they got to hand me the water bottle or they get fired. He says, I'm the guy who prepares properly. And so when I go to the tour, I'm not afraid to win. And I'm not afraid to lose either. And I thought, like, what else can you say that's better competitive temperament than just being absolutely fearless of all outcomes? And you certainly embodied that because you were fearless to make a 9-second PR. Maybe the timer helped, the poor French translation or whatever they did. But, you know, somehow you broke through to that realm, at least temporarily, and got to float in the atmosphere.
Yeah. And, you know, you could think of these things. Our traits are not fixed in concrete, so we can exist on different ends of that spectrum. But if Lance is on one extreme spectrum of confidence, and let's say when I got to my first Olympic trials, I was on the other spectrum of thinking I don't belong there, I would say that most people, like, you could say at that Olympic trials, I didn't really belong there. I was not competitive. I was not as ready to race with those guys. But in a lot of cases, and I think this is sort of a life insight, even when we do belong, the most of us, it's more common to err on the side of you know, the imposter syndrome of, feeling like you don't belong even when you do.
Right. What are you doing on the bestseller list, Alex? Come on. These are, you know, John Grisham.
And in every context, you know, this is a very common thing. And it has repercussions, I think. Like, in part, it can make you work harder. It can fuel you to make sure you prove you do belong. But I think it can be a real drain on your energy if you're constantly worried that actually people are going to discover that you don't belong there, that you don't belong on that start line. You're not as good as your competitors, where in reality, often you are and you do.
So you talked yourself into that. It took you a year, and then you got back to the Nationals and placed highly. But then you describe hitting that plateau, which seems to be expected because your plateau is a national caliber runner who's training extremely hard and right on the razor edge of success or failure by definition, trying to hit that highest point. Do you think there's now a genetic component or some other missing link that allowed you to, you had tremendous genetic talent to be able to run up to 3:44, and then why didn't you break El Guerrouj's record since you had all that exercise physiology background?
Yeah, so I ended up running 3:42. Just I have to set the record straight. Ooh. On that.
Okay, so that's a legit sub 4 minute mile for you American listeners.
If you go to the official World Athletics conversion tables, my 1500 PR works out to a 4:01 mile. And I will take that to my grave. I will swear to my grave that personally my endurance profile is stronger than my speed, so I would have run 3:59.99.
Well, now we have the springy spike, so you're a 3:57 miler by today's
I feel like
definition.
A 3:20
right?
miler. So let me start with the excuses. I ran 3:42 in 97 when I was 21. I got injured the next year. And I missed the next three years. I missed the next two track seasons completely. And I just was starting to come back running like 20 miles a week in that third year. And when I came back, I never quite got my snap back. I ran 3:43 a few years later, and I ran a 13:52 5K. So I was basically at a lower, I never got back to the level I was at in 97 as a 21-year-old. So I can blame a little bit that I had this knee problem that kept me out for a couple of years. But so I think even at the fitness I was at in 97, had I gotten into a fast race, maybe there was a 3:39 there or something like that. But there was no 3:35, and there was definitely no 3:32, and there was 100% no 3:29 or 3:25. Like there's, you know, I'm at level whatever, 14, and I'm, you know, we're talking about level 60. I'm a long way from those. And so genetics, yeah, a lot of it was genetics. But I guess what I would, if I sort of push myself to think about this, I would say that genetics had very little to do with where I ended up on the spec. Like, let's say genetics is going to say Alex was never going to run 3:32. I don't think my genetics precluded me from running, let's say, 3:35 or something, which is still a long, long way from what I actually ran. And then why didn't I run faster? Well, I was an extremely nervous racer. I was too cautious. All of my races once I got to that level started out slow and finished fast. I ran my 3:42 on 40 miles a week, which is really quite low for that level of running. It's not that I was stupid. I understood that 80 miles a week would be better. But I had a lot of trouble getting up that high without injury. Like, in fact, I was trying to raise my mileage when I got injured and was out for a few years. And I don't think genetics is what explains why I got injured. I don't think that was impossible. If you gave me 10 lives to live, in some of those lives, I would have figured out how to raise my mileage without getting hurt. I would have found a different pair of shoes or a different place to run or a different, you know. So I think I'm 100% a believer in genetics. Like there's just no doubt. Like you can, you know, I went to my daughter's elementary school cross country a few days ago, and you can see they're 6 years old, and there's differences in how people run, and those, they're not perfect predictors, but they do track with, you know, who has the potential to be really fast someday and who doesn't. So genetics is real, but in my case, I would say genetics wasn't the ultimate factor that dictated where I stopped. And for most of us, that I think that's the case. We don't get. I think there are very few people walking on this planet who can say, "Yeah, that time I ran my best time. That's as fast as my genes would permit me to run."
Mm-hmm. Right. It's very difficult to reach your genetic potential, which is 99.9% faster than your PR, because all things perfect. Yeah. And geez, 21. I mean, you know, you had another decade, especially these days where people prolong their careers for progression and improvement.
I did try it. I did try. So I missed a few key years. I tried really hard from, 25 to 28. And I, when I was 28, I was probably in the shape of my life, I would say. And I got a stress fracture in my sacrum 3 months before that year's Olympic trials. And that was kind of the end of my track day. I said, I've had enough. I couldn't stay healthy. But it's not that I gave up. I tried and I couldn't run as fast as I did. And again, that's another thing I think that fuels my interest in trying to understand the limits of endurance. Because when I was 26, I was doing workouts that I could never have dreamed of when I was 21, but I wasn't racing as fast. And so was I a little bit overtrained, to go back to, a point you raised before I started rambling several questions ago. Like maybe I was pushing too hard in the workouts, or maybe there was something different in my, my confidence was different, or whatever the case may be. I sometimes think about, workout to race conversion. Everyone has a different, if one person does 5 by a mile at such and such a time, they're going to race at a certain level. But someone else doing that workout might race at a completely different level. And what determines those conversions? How do you know how the relationship between what you can do in training and then that sort of magic alchemy of racing, where you can always, or hopefully always, get a little more out of your body than you can during workouts?
I want to discuss the incredible benefits of red light therapy and how you can get started with Mito Red Light. Mito, like mitochondria, red light makes the premier light therapy devices in the world and at incredibly affordable prices. I stand in front of my Mito Pro 1500 unit every morning, carefully exposing my eyeballs, other important balls, and my entire body to special wavelengths of red and near infrared light. When I tell people about my daily devotion to red light therapy, they typically ask, "Does this stuff really work?" And the answer is yes, and there are thousands of studies supporting its effectiveness. Here's how. It's called photobiomodulation, where specific wavelengths of red and near-infrared light, red's visible, near-infrared is not visible, that's why it looks like only half of your panel's working, these wavelengths help mitochondria in cells throughout your body produce more energy and clear waste products more efficiently. Red light exposure helps mobilize nitric oxide trapped in the mitochondria and allows oxygen to return to the cell and increase ATP production. The benefits are proven again and again for skin health, muscle recovery, joint pain, and numerous inflammatory conditions. Red light therapy is also beneficial for circadian rhythm alignment, because we generally get far too little direct sunlight and too much indoor blue light from screens and light bulbs at the wrong times. You don't hear much about this benefit of red light therapy, but when I turn on those lights first thing in the morning, as soon as I wake up, I walk across the hall, I stand in front of the panels, and I feel instantly awake and energized. And believe me, there's a lot of days where Mr. Health Guy here wakes up feeling a little groggy and a little whiny, like I don't want to get up now and get into my morning exercise routine. But when I stand in front of the lights, in 1 minute, I swear I feel wide awake. I get all that grogginess out naturally. It's super powerful, super effective. Besides all the healing and the cellular benefits, I also love it for being a natural wake-up machine. You have to try red light therapy. I am certain that you will become a devoted user. And guess what? Mito Red Light offers a 60-day no-risk trial period and a special 5% discount for BRAD podcast listeners. Just visit Mito Red Light, M-I-T-O, redlight.com, and use the code BRAD on any of their products. Go for it today and get started on your red light journey.
Right. And there's examples of those, what do you call them, training superhero, where they're not even close to their competitive potential and apparently due to excess energy expenditure in workouts and those overtraining patterns, or that overly competitive, you know, lack of regulating your competitive intensity.
Yeah, and it's hard to know what, like, how much of that is they're tired, right? Like they're not recovered from the workouts, and how much of that is like something that's more subtle, that they're digging into some sort of, it's not the energy stores, but some sort of mental stores that you don't have. You know, you can't go to the sixth gear twice a week and then expect to really be able to harness it in a race too. I don't have the answers here, but I think that the questions point us in some interesting directions as to how do you figure out what that balance is of pushing hard enough but not too hard.
Kevin Young, when he broke the world record in 1992, 400 meter hurdles, which held for a long time until recently, he was working with my friend Dr. Greenberg, and one of the psycho emotional things he was trying to clear was fear of success, because a lot of athletes, when they're training so hard and they're living and breathing their sport and their competitive goals, there is an unknown, or I guess unacknowledged, fear of what happens when I do reach all my dreams. Then what? And you get that letdown, which is often talked about, the post Ironman blues, they call it, or what have you. So maybe deep down people are afraid to, they put their goal time on the sticky note and obsess about it, but are afraid to actually transcend.
It's one of those things that sounds so funny, but I think there's some truth to it, the idea of fear of success. But I think I something I've always thought is that one of the ways that running has prepared me for life is the realization that achieving your goals or meeting your dreams, you don't just sort of magically shimmer up into paradise when you, like, so when I ran 352, I exceeded all of my dreams and it was great and I loved it. But a week later, I was, you know, life was back to normal. And it's like, okay, what's next? What can I, as soon as you get there, you're wondering what's next. And that's a kind of, it's good and bad, right? Like it keeps you going, but you know, I think many of us, let's say, need to work on enjoying the victories when they come, as opposed to always thinking about the next thing. But I know when I think about career or even relationships and all these things, I think running has prepared me well for the idea that even if everything I'm dreaming of comes true, life will go on the next day and I'll have to think of other dreams, because you can't just sort of float on that cloud indefinitely. And so whether you reach your running goals or your athletic goals, or whether you don't, I'm descending into cliches here, but ultimately it is the journey, not the destination. Because I was lucky enough to meet some of my running goals. It was great, but it does, you can't live on that for the rest of your life.
And I suppose if you are able to appreciate the journey as the essence of what you're doing, according to some of this research that you cite in the book, it's possible to smile your way, self-talk your way into a reduction in perceived exertion. In other words, I love these workouts so much, irrespective of my goals and my competitive measurements, that they're going to be more enjoyable and less strenuous.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is tying it back to what we were talking about earlier about as an analytical person, learning to being willing to accept that there's a role for the brain. The self-talk literature is the one that for me helped to sort of turn the corner for me, that you can do randomized trials of having people work on saying different things to themselves in the middle of some, an endurance, a time trial or whatever. And lo and behold, they have an effect on performance. What you're telling yourself, it alters your perceived effort. So if you're sitting there telling yourself, this is really hard, this is really hard, this is so bad, I hate it, then it's not surprising that if your perception of how hard you're working gets higher, and if you've got a big grimace on your face to show how hard you're working, that you feel like you're working harder, and as a result you slow down. And whereas if you're telling yourself, this is where I want to be, I there's no place in the world that I'd rather be, I chose to be here, and it's uncomfortable, but that's what I've chosen and it's okay, I can deal with it, then you're like, this is 6 out of 10, it's tolerable, I can keep going. And you do. And so those studies that have actually shown an effect, they help convince the analytical part of my mind that this isn't just a whole bunch of sort of touchy-feely, feel-good stuff. This is science.
Yeah, I guess it could even count if you're thinking silly things like, I just want to come second to last. I don't want to be last. Or I'm not going to lose to this jerk. He's wearing sneakers and I have the springy $250 shoes. It'll like propel you forward, even if it's sort of a negative or a simplistic notion like that.
And I think that, you know, it's definitely worth acknowledging that everyone's wired differently, right? Like some people, and anytime I discuss the sort of the idea of positive self-talk and you know, smiling and stuff, I'll run into someone who's like, personally, I run my best times when I'm mad, you know, when I'm pissed off and angry at somebody. And, you know, I'm not saying that's not true, that everyone's different. And even like response to pressure. So for me, I was someone who got pretty wound up before races. And so for me, saying all I need to do is come second last, so I'm not the asshole who came last, that was probably a good approach for me, you know, at least in the context of a field of runners, all of whom were fast, and that, you know, I that staying with would be good because it took the pressure off. I wasn't worried about covering the moods of the guys who were in for second and third. For other people, or let's say for a stronger runner, that would have been a terrible strategy for someone who's trying to win the race. If you're just saying all I need to do is come second last, that you're going to underperform. So there's a sort of infinite variety of ways that your own personal psychology can interact with the specific situation where you're racing. But the sort of the common denominator is you have to find ways of, you know, of not necessarily encouraging yourself, but of creating space for yourself to push without being scared of the consequences of whether things don't go as well as you hoped.
So back to this idea of, okay, we're going to embrace our power, and our mindsets are the arbiter of fatigue in the body. We can self-talk our way and smile our way to reduce perceived exertion. And then here's Alex with another injury to the sacrum, ending his running career, and all the setbacks I've had, where I can reflect back and go, oh, geez. I love high jumping so much in the old man division that I busted up my heel, and now I need to have a minor procedure, and I'm not going to be jumping for a while. And it was clearly because I was out there unleashing my competitive intensity to the extreme that my body couldn't take it. And so the central governor does fine when I'm at my 15th jump in practice, and I know I have five more in me because I'm so enthused about it. But then where do you put the governor on in general everyday life, so that you're not leaving your best results in the training ground?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I had the perfect answer to that, I'd be a millionaire, obviously. And lots of people are trying to sell us on their products that will monitor training and recovery. I think one thing I would say is I would distinguish between the discomfort or pain of effort and the discomfort of an injury. And it's not always easy to tell those two things apart. I mean, if as a runner, if every time you felt an ache or a pain or an niggle, you're like, well, I'm going to be smart and I'm going to take a couple of days off until this ache clears up. Yeah. You would run 10 miles a year, right? Like you have to be willing to push through discomfort sometimes, even acute physical discomfort. But I think it's a little, I think it's, the central governor, we can talk about it in the context of pushing through the desire to stop. But acute pain localized to one particular part of your body, that we have to not rely on the central governor to protect us from. That we have to use our conscious cognitive resources to say, all right, how many days have I had this discomfort? Is it getting better or worse? Is it increasing during exercise, or is it sort of numbing during exercise? Is it worse when I get up in the morning? And, you know, and even if you know, if you're paying attention to all these things, it doesn't necessarily mean that you know whether you can push through things. But I think we have to take active ownership of the kind of mechanics of keeping our bodies working. And again, it depends, you know, if you're training for a race, a local race, then you just want to do the best you can. Versus if you're trying to make the Olympics, you might make different choices on the cost benefit, the risk reward ratio of taking a day off versus pushing through something. These days, I try to be, I still run, I still compete, but it's not, you know, central to my life. And so if something starts to hurt, then I'm more inclined to just back off. But at the same time, as we're talking today, like I'm going to be running the provincial, maybe national masters cross country championships this year for fun. My heel's been bugging me for the last couple of days. I suspect it's probably plantar fasciitis or something like that. But I have a big workout this afternoon. My weekly workout with my friends, I go down and we do a good cross country workout, and I'm going to go to the workout. And there is a voice in my head that's saying, Alex, you know, if you let plantar fasciitis become like established, it's going to be a pain in the neck or a pain in the heel for a long time. Don't play around with this. But at the same time, I'm like, there's less than a month. There's 3 weeks until the cross country championships. This is the key workout. This is the prime time. So these are hard trade-offs to make. But I guess the key thing is I'm not just relying on my body or my brain to automatically know that this is the when I need to shut down, and I'm not pushing through I'm not pushing through a sort of defense mechanism. I'm coolly and calmly weighing the pros and cons and maybe acknowledging that I'm not as rational as I think that I'm being pulled along by my desires. And
he's looking from the 30,000 foot view. Okay. There goes that guy with this stiff heel running another workout with his buddies.
This is don't do what I'm doing. Do what I know what I should be doing. I'm just choosing not to do it. So maybe that's a different form of not central governor, the reverse, the central idiot or whatever.
Central breaker. Yeah. It amazingly seems like even at the highest elite level of sport, we're not doing a great job at keeping the athletes healthy. And it could be part and parcel to trying to shave those tenths off the existing records and get the gold medal. But I'm also curious if we're missing, you know, a giant big picture insight where, you know, these multi-million dollar NBA basketball players or football players are rushed back onto the court because in the name of being professionals, and they don't want to miss too many games. And same with the Olympic athletes. And we had the great 800 meter runners from America that were picking up medals and looking like they were, you know, marching toward the world record. And then they can't even get on the track to try the trials to make the next team due to injuries and other setbacks. And I don't know. What do you think? Is it going to be par for the course? Or is there, if you dreamed up and you were the coach of the Olympic team, would you do something different?
Yeah, I'm a little bit pessimistic. So I've had this conversation recently in the context of the new breed of thick ultra cushioned running shoes. And someone was asking me like, oh, well, do you think if people are training in these, people train in these, you know, cushier shoes, will it reduce injuries? Will it allow? And my response was, okay, maybe not. You can argue it in both ways, whether it's protective of injury. You can argue that maybe it's going to change your biomechanics in a way that's going to make you more susceptible to injury, or maybe the reduced cushioning is going to make you less susceptible to injury. But the bigger picture view is that, let's say hypothetically, that running in big cushioned shoes allows you, it reduces stress on your body. Then runners are going to train more. And they're going to train, and there's a concept called risk homeostasis, which is the idea that we sort of have a, everyone's different, but each person has a sort of level of risk they're willing to tolerate. And if you make, you know, the classic study on this is anti-lock brakes, which was done in, I think, somewhere in Germany on taxi cabs. They installed anti-lock brakes to see if it would reduce accidents, and it didn't. It just had the cab drivers drive faster. So they were able to go faster, and they ended up operating at the same level of risk. Now, risk, that does not to say that, like, this argument gets extended to bike helmets to say that, oh, well, therefore bike helmets don't work because people will just bike faster. And I'm like, no, I don't believe that we have perfect risk homeostasis. You can do things that make you safer that you don't fully compensate for by, even if there is a little bit of, maybe you bike a little faster with a bike helmet, but I still believe bike helmets are, although the evidence is murkier than you'd think, I still believe they have likely benefits to protection. But getting back to the injury question, I think Once the stakes are sufficiently high, as they are in professional sport, the athletes at the top level are not interested in self-actualization or like, I wonder how good I can be with, well, not taking any risks. Mm-hmm. They want to do whatever it takes to win. And if a shoe, so they're making decisions that maybe give them a 30% chance of getting injured any given year. If a shoe lowers that, they'll just start training harder till they're back up to 30%. Not in a perfect way. And that's not to say that people can't make better decisions. But I think, yeah, I mean, fundamentally with sport, we're at a level now of full professionalization where the only limit on how hard people train or how much time they spend or how much many resources they pour into their training is the point of diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. And that point of diminishing returns is probabilistic. So if, let's say you decide, I'm going to stop at this level of training because then I can be pretty confident I'm going to make it to the start line in one piece. Well, you've got 10 competitors who are all going to train at a higher level, and 8 of them might get injured because they're idiots. They're doing a risky thing, but 2 of them just by the luck of the draw are going to make it through. And so if you want to get, or 3 of them, let's say, if you want to make it on the podium, ultimately you have to train at that self-destructive level of training because there's enough people doing it that some of them are going to survive. And so it becomes a probabilistic throw. And this is a very pessimistic view of the world.
You're describing the NCAA distance programs at all the schools where there's 20 kids and 7 of them make it through cross country injury free and 4 of them excel to their potential. And then it's like survival of the fittest in the worst way. And it's playing out everywhere. I mean, it's not even a bad comment. It's an accurate description of how we operate.
Yeah. I think any honest NCAA coach would admit that, yeah, that's pretty much how it works. Because unfortunately, you can see that it's irrational for an individual runner to train that way. But like it or not, if you have a program and the goal of the program is to win, that's a rational way to run the program. We all love the stories of the carefully developed runners who are nurtured and protected. And a lot of coaches are honestly trying to do that for sure. But ultimately, if you have the raw material and you can train them hard enough, then you don't need everyone to survive if you want to just score 5.
All right. Let's go try to find some honest coaches to admit they're grinding these guys through a meat market. So we talked about genetics a little bit, and now we've talked about how, the elite athletes have been pushing the limits for a long time. And I'm wondering if you see that we are bumping up against the ceiling with some of the world records, such as El Guerrouj holding this record now for 24, 25 years. He was a unique genetic talent. He trained harder than probably any human ever and lived that monastic lifestyle, which is no longer existent. I think today's elite athletes are pumping up their social media in between workouts rather than laying in a dorm and reading a passage from scripture or something. Same with Usain Bolt being 6'5" and having those excellent mechanics and all that. So I wonder what your reflection is on that. I guess I'm talking about track and field mostly because it's so easy to quantify.
Yeah, I think we can extend from track to all other activities, but track is one where you can see that you can plot the charts and you can see, I mean, the idea that we're in an era of diminishing returns is, I think, pretty hard to argue against. We've been in an era of diminishing returns for a long time.
And what do you mean by that?
Like, no one's going to break the record by large amounts.
Oh, right.
But it's not like, if you look at the curve in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, it's like people were taking chunks off world records left, right, and center. And then we're at this point, it's kind of level.
Except the 400 hurdles.
Well, that's not the only exception. Level. Before the 2008 Olympics, people were writing that. This article gets written. Scientists write studies every 5 years or so showing that progress is leveling off and we're very close to ultimate limits. And then it's just like, well, except that Usain Bolt changed, broke the world record by a cumulative total of, I can't remember, 1.5% or something like that, something enormous. So, and you can retroactively say, oh, well, Bolt was a freak of nature. Well, it's like, that's that's who sets world records, as freaks of nature. And yes, he had tall legs, but we had a very mature world record. It's not like tall people didn't exist until 2007, right? Like, we had lots of tall people trying to sprint. Nobody set the world record. All of a sudden, Bolt took it to a different level and others followed. And then we can look at marathon running. It's like, or all distance running. The shoes came in 2017-ish. There's been a huge change in a whole world records at basically every distance. You can say, well, that doesn't count as progress because that's technology. So like, yeah, well, there was technology. I mean, I agree with that for sure. Yeah. But there was also technological change when all weather tracks came in and, you know, fiberglass pole vaults. Like the history of progress in world records has always been intertwined with changes in the context and in the technology. So, or you could say, well, what happened in the, you know, well, there were a lot of world records in the 80s. It's like, yeah, well, there were a lot of drugs in the 80s. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of world records, you know, in the Eastern Bloc, and not just the Eastern Bloc for sure. In the 90s, there were a lot of world records. Well, there was no EPO test in the 90s, and there was EPO. So it's like we're approaching limits, except that every time we've never actually hit the limits because there's always something. And so I guess what I would say is there's this sort of hypothetical pure idea of pure progress. It's like humans have gotten faster only by wanting it more or training smarter or doing something different. And I think, I don't think we've necessarily maxed that out. Like, I think especially for complicated to train, like endurance events are maybe there's more variables you can twist in terms of figuring out a way that, oh, maybe the Norwegians have figured out that doing four threshold workouts a week really is a better way, and you're going to get some progress. But so there's some wiggle room there. But I think what we're in the real world, what we're going to see is that world records continue to get broken. There will often be an explanation for why they got broken, whether it's a change in rules, a change in technology, a change in nutrition. Now you can get your carbs in a hydrogel that allows you to take more, whatever. So if you want to say those don't count as progress, then yeah, progress is going to be a little more rare. Mm. But I think I never would have predicted that shoes would allow runners to get a couple percent faster. Like it literally never crossed my mind until it happened. And so that makes me open to the idea that something else that's somehow within the rules but has never crossed my mind might open up new performance vistas in one event or another.
I guess within the rules or right beneath the rules, when we're talking about the state of the union in doping, do you have any insights on that these days? I was fascinated to read Tyler Hamilton's book about microdosing EPO every night with a little pinch and then testing clean in the morning. It's like, okay, well, we see people climbing as fast or faster than Lance Armstrong up Alpe d'Huez and the measured climbs. And so to me, that's kind of an indication we had some good genetic talent and hard training there with the previous era. And if they're matching that now, I would have to project. I don't know. What do you think? Same with track and field question.
Yeah.
I mean, we're almost beating Flojo's records and some of the other people who were pretty well confirmed to be competing in the doping era, if nothing else.
Yeah, and in Flojo's case with a 5 meter a second tailwind when she's 100 meter world record.
0.0. Okay.
Oh, my mistake. Yes.
Yeah. I call Elaine Thompson the fastest female of all time because that you got to throw things out. I mean, someone needs to have the guts to do that. Come on, Sebastian Coe, if you're listening.
Exactly. That's a whole nother rabbit hole. Yeah, doping. Look, it's always going to be there. In the same sense that it doesn't matter what rules you make against stealing, there's still shoplifting. And just because people shoplift, it doesn't mean we should say, not that you made this argument, but just because people still shoplift doesn't mean you should say, well, we tried getting rid of stealing, we should just make it legal because it's part of, it's a never ending fight. People will try and cheat. We need to stop them. How are we doing in this fight against cheating? I think the biological passport has narrowed the bandwidth available to dopers. You can't just be on the industrial strength diesel now, or at least it's much harder to do that. So I'm moderately optimistic in that sense. The fact that runners and cyclists are sort of performing as well or pretty close to as well as some admitted doped up previous generations, I don't know. I can, maybe it's just they're going to bed earlier and they're using their foam roller more religiously or whatever the case may be. Like, it's hard to know, and just in order to preserve sanity and to preserve interest in sport, I have to give people the benefit of the doubt and let, you know, there's, unless there's a certain amount of smoke that starts to, you know, smoke beyond. I think the performance on its own is a tricky way of there is some interesting research with using performance trajectories to identify people who should undergo more targeted testing, and I think that's great.
Yeah, but Charlie Francis drew those graphs, and it was widely ridiculed. Remember the spikes in the graph when he was showing the progression of world records, claiming that everybody was doping. And like, what does this guy know? You know, well, he knew everything.
It turns out he knew everything. Yeah, I guess to sum up the doping thing, I think it's always going to be part of it. Hopefully, the balance has shifted a little bit compared to where it was in the 80s and 90s, where I think things were pretty. And I guess actually in the 2000s too. But yeah, you have to keep your head not buried too deeply in the sand. Even if you want to be optimistic, you have to acknowledge that every performance is subject to the possibility that it was cheating, and that's
I like to make the assumption that the playing field is level, and so if we have eight lanes in the finals of an explosive event like the 100 meters. And there's doping suspicions because someone breaks a record, I'd like to think that all eight participants have equal access to whatever advantages are they're getting. I mean, same with looking at the NFL, Miami's playing Cleveland, and these guys are big and fast and strong. So I'd like to assume that whatever they're doing in the weight room and with their needles is equal. It's pretty reasonable assumption to make.
I'll take a slightly more
nationalistic point of view. No, Canadians are clean.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. But I'll take a slightly more delusional approach, let's say, which is that I like to imagine that there's some athletes who are choosing to compete clean, and that little by little we'll keep chipping away, even if it's retroactively, at the ones who are found to have cheated, and that virtue will be rewarded. I think that's not an assumption that can probably bear intense scrutiny in the real world, but I sleep better hoping that it's not just that everyone's doping equally, but some people are doing it right. And it's hard to just do a sniff test and figure out who's doing that, other than you get nationalistic involved. I know the Canadians are doing it right because I met that person's cousin's aunt's roommate's friend 6 years ago. But I hope some people are. I know some people are doing it right. I know some people are doing it right and competing at the highest levels.
Oh, for sure. And I had Shelby Houlihan on the show, and it was such a heartbreaking story. I'm deeply convinced that all her character shows is that she's into the highest ideals of sport and appears to be a tragic victim of the system that's trying to go out there and perhaps. We've gone overboard. When you talk about that balance of power in the 80s, the dopers own the world sports scene, and now perhaps the anti-doping agencies are causing some tragic fallout from doing the best they can to test at higher levels of scrutiny that might not line up well with reality.
Honestly, I don't have a perfect solution to that, because you can't have zero tolerance without having innocent victims, and there's no such thing as a complete lack of false positives. And so, I don't know how you identify those, and I don't know how you deal with it. It's one of those problems that it's like, even if I was unilaterally appointed the absolute king of anti-doping or of world athletics or something like that, I don't know that I have a great solution to that. I don't know how you come up with rule, because we've come up with rules that can be applied impartially to try and solve those problems. I do think, accountability is important, and world anti-doping agencies should definitely have an obligation to accountability and to explain the procedures. But it's no test is perfect. That's tricky.
I do like your shoplifting analogy. I think that's the first time I've had shoplifting associated with doping, but it's great. You got to keep fighting the battle and put on more cameras and follow them out to the parking lot, whatever. You can't just lie down.
Yeah, just assume that, we tried getting rid of shoplifting, and I guess we should make it say it's okay. No, It sucks that people still do it, but we've got to keep fighting it.
Alex Hutchinson, great stuff. Thanks so much for joining me. Listeners are going to have to grab that book, Endure. It's a wonderful read, wonderful listen. And where else can we connect with you, or got any exciting projects you want to talk about?
Thanks so much for this conversation, Brad. I'm sorry. Many of my answers were extremely rambling, but you asked interesting questions.
That's how we roll, man. It was great. Yeah.
Yeah. So probably the easiest place to find me is on Twitter. My handle is sweatscience, all one word. Anytime I write an article in a place like Outside, I post it there. So that's the sort of one-stop shop. I'm working on another book, but by God, it's going slowly. So it'll be a while before it gets out.
Believe in yourself, man. You can do it. You belong
there.
That's
right. Yeah. I'm at the 401 stage. Hopefully I'll get to the 352 stage.
Okay, I love it.
Yeah. Before too long.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Dun, 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 dun.
I want to tell you about wildhealth.com. They're an online provider of comprehensive precision medicine and health consultation services. They offer DNA analysis, custom lab panels, extensive medical intake form with family history and lifestyle preferences, and regular online visits with a board-certified precision medicine physician and a health coach whom you can message anytime through their convenient app. Wild Health evaluates your data to determine what you need for nutrition, exercise, sleep, and supplements, and you can experiment, consult, and retest to get everything dialed in. You'll get a cutting-edge epigenetic test of DNA methylation to calculate your all-important biological age and have fun lowering your age over time instead of following the mainstream path to accelerated aging. It's time to strive for awesome instead of just normal. Did you realize that only 6.8% of Americans are deemed metabolically healthy and only 2% are declared optimal? That's disgraceful, but you can turn things around quickly. Please visit wildhealth.com and you will see that this is the absolute gold standard of personalized medicine, and it's available to you right now. Telemedicine available anywhere in the USA. Wild Health is generously extending BRAD podcast listeners 20% off the cost of membership. Just visit wildhealth.com/Brad or use the code BRAD20 at checkout to get 20% off and start taking control of your health today at wildhealth.com/Brad. Thank you for listening to the show. I love sharing the experience with you and greatly appreciate your support. Please email podcast@bradventures.com with feedback, suggestions, and questions for the Q&A shows. Subscribe to our email list at bradkearns.com for a weekly blast about the published episodes and a wonderful bi-monthly newsletter edition with informative articles and practical tips for all aspects of healthy living. You can also download several awesome free ebooks when you subscribe to the email list. And if you could go to the trouble to leave a 5 or 5-star review with Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the shows, that would be super incredibly awesome. It helps raise the profile of the BRAD podcast and attract new listeners. And did you know that you can share a show with a friend or loved one by just hitting a few buttons in your player and firing off a text message? My awesome podcast player called Overcast allows you to actually record a soundbite excerpt from the episode you're listening to and fire it off with a quick text message. Thank you so much for spreading the word. And remember, be rad.